So, have y'all ever experienced something so awesome that you just want to tell everyone, but you have this feeling that no one will believe you, but you end up telling, like, you try your best to tell everyone you can because you're so excited about it, but as you're talking, you see the looks of disbelief, the looks of confusion, and you end up just saying that phrase of defeat, you just had to be there. Well, for me, my freshman year at Liberty, I played on the volleyball team. And that first week of the season, first week of the year, we had our training week. And every day for the week, we woke up super early and we lifted weights. We had class and then we had practice in the afternoon and then we ran sprints in the evening. And this was to get you in the best mental and physical shape that you could be in for this upcoming season. And we had guys throwing up every day. I actually don't think we stopped running sprints until my coach was satisfied with the amount of people that threw up. We had a couple of guys quit, and then I lost 15 pounds. It may not sound like much, but that's 15 pounds in 1 week. So I was in the best shape that I could be for the season. But after surviving training week, the seniors took us freshmen on a little trip as our reward for surviving. For geographical context, the James River runs right through Lynchburg City. And just north of Lynchburg, there's a little island called Treasure Island. And Liberty actually used to own this island. It was their athletics wing. So it had dorms, it had buildings for athletics like training and had weight rooms and all of that. And they had some fields for practice and, you know, like athletic stuff. I don't really know how any of that stuff got there because there was no bridge connecting to the island on either side. But we swam there. And I just want to say this now that the James River is by far the most disgusting river I've ever been in. And I've literally walked through sewers. So that's saying something. But we swam there, and when we got there, this island was like straight out of an apocalypse movie. There was a bunch of deer and hogs and chickens. I don't know how they got there, but there was dorms and buildings, and everything was run down. Walls were falling apart. Stairs were falling apart. There was natural sunlight or sunroofs. Just trees and different plants just shooting up out of the concrete. It looked really cool. But basically, the seniors' gift to us for surviving training week was exploring this abandoned apocalyptic island for the day. And it was awesome. It was so cool. I'm not going to lie. I had so much fun. I wouldn't go back because that means I would have to swim the James again, but it was still fun. But we got to this point on our little adventure that there was a collapsed building in our way. So you had one way to get through. You could walk on the rusted roof of the building. You could walk around through thorn brush and most likely poison ivy, or you could burrow under and crawl through, which was nasty. So our captain, being the great leader and captain he is, went first. How many, raise your hand if you know anything about volleyball. Wow, okay. This is good. Okay, so our captain was the libero. He was like maybe 5'5", and I think 135 pounds. And the last time I was that small, I was in elementary school. So I am 6'5", and at the time, I was 210 pounds, 215 maybe. So I took maybe 3 steps and then fell through the rusted roof. It was kind of like Wile E. Coyote whenever he ran off the ledge and like his legs fell first and his eyes went second. Like it really felt like that. And surprisingly, I only got the breath knocked out of me, but all the guys I was with thought I died. And they were all freaking out, like, John, like calling my name, like, he's dead. What are we going to do? We shouldn't even be here. And I, like, obviously I couldn't answer. So I just had to crawl out to the front where they were. And I gave them a thumbs up. I'm like, I'm okay. And I just crawled through. And it was so nasty. But I crawled through. And when I got to the other side, I saw that my leg was completely torn up, the one that fell through first. And then my teammate told me that my back was torn up and actually bleeding through my shirt. But we finished the day. We had fun. And actually played in a tournament the very next day, me with my leg and back completely wrapped up. Surprising, I didn't get tetanus. I can eat regular food, not through a straw. I don't have lockjaw. I'm okay. But even just saying that, I see looks of disbelief, looks of confusion. So I guess you just had to be there. But Moses had a similar, if not a little more extreme situation. He had to convince the Israelites and the Pharaoh that God himself sent him to get the Israelites. And if y'all turn to Exodus 4, we'll see in verses 1 through 17 that Moses makes a bunch of excuses not to live in God's command. But ultimately, this wasn't because he didn't think the Israelites and Pharaoh would believe him. Ultimately, it was out of lack of faith in God. And I think that's something that we can all relate to. I know I can. But Moses begins in verse 1. He says, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" Clearly, Moses doubts the Israelites' ability to listen. He, in saying this, he's remembering what happened for us in chapter 2, verse 14, when he split up the fighting Israelites and one of them said, "Who are you? Who made you king to rule over us?" And in remembering that, he's, rather than acting out of fear of God and acting in obedience, he's acting out of fear of man and disobeying God. And to be fair, he's not too far off in saying that the Israelites will not believe him, because their history will be marred with disbelief. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, hundreds of years worth of ignoring and not believing prophets, and of course, killing Jesus. The Israelites' history will be marred with disbelief. So he's not too far off in saying this. And also, the Israelites won't be in the same position as Moses. Moses heard God talking to him. Moses saw the burning bush that wasn't burning. But still, he's acting out of fear of man and disobedience rather than acting out of fear of God and obedience. The key word here is to believe. It's something less than faith in the New Testament sense, but here in the original context, Moses is saying that they won't believe what he says to be true, that he's just lying and making it up. And to listen isn't just hearing him out, it's being willing and able to act on what he is saying as truth. So really, Moses is envisioning a response from the Israelites: "We don't believe you, and we won't follow you." But God answers him, starting in verse 2. He says, "What is in your hand?" He said, "A staff." He said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses ran away from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, "Put your hand inside your cloak." And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said again, put your hand back inside your cloak. And he did it and took it out, and behold, his flesh was restored. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it onto dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So God's response to Moses is that it's not Moses that the Israelites will be listening to, but it's God that the Israelites and Pharaoh will be listening to. Literally, the text speaks of the voice of the first and latter sign. So that goes to say that it's the message being conveyed by the signs that matters and not the physical effects produced from them. The first sign shows God's power over Egypt and his will to save them. The second sign shows God's power over sickness and his will to protect them. The third sign shows God's power over life and ultimately death, expressing his will to provide for him. We'll go back through the signs just real quickly and hit them one by one. First sign, the staff turning into the serpent. God says, what's in your hand? It's a staff. Put it on the ground, becomes a snake, scared of the snake, runs away. God tells him, pick it up. He picks it up and it turns back into a staff. Snake is the same word used for serpent in Genesis 3. That same serpent that tempted Adam and Eve, that same serpent that was cursed by God. So God is showing his sovereignty over good and evil. But even more intimately to Moses's and the Israelites' context, the regular headdress of the pharaohs was a big headdress with a metal clasp of a cobra on the front of it. And the cobra signified the power, the dominion, and the magic that was bestowed upon the Pharaoh as the Egyptians' god from the gods that they serve. So even more intimately, God is showing his sovereignty over Egypt, Israelites' captors, that ultimately he is in control of what happens. Moving on to the next sign, God tells Moses to put his hand in the cloak, pulls it out, leprous, tells him to put it back in, pulls it out, clean. In the future, when the Israelites are camping in the wilderness and when they have their own society, a leper would be cast out from society because they were deemed unclean and they had to live with the rest of the lepers, the rest of the unclean people until they were deemed clean by the head priest. Ultimately, they would die alone. They would die an outcast. But in doing this, God is showing his sovereignty over sickness, his power over sickness. Moving on to the third sign. If they don't believe either of these two signs, take some water from the Nile, put it on the ground, it will turn into blood. The Nile was very significant and actually considered sacred to the Egyptians because all life for the Egyptians came from the Nile. All fish, all crops was all from there. So it was considered sacred and a gift from the gods. So clearly turning the water that brings life into blood is a pretty significant sign. It's a pretty significant miracle. And it shows God's ultimate power to overwhelm the Egyptians. But even with these signs, Jesus displayed these things in his own ministry, showing his power over evil in Matthew 8, 23 through 34, showing his power over sickness in Matthew 8, 1 through 4, showing his power over death in Matthew 9, 18 through 25, the ultimate expression of these being in his death on the cross and resurrection. even amongst all of these signs, Moses still answers with more doubt. But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." Here we see that Moses doubts his own ability to lead. Fun fact, Moses was actually described as powerful in speech by the martyr Stephen in Acts 7, verse 22. So it could be that Moses is simply being overmodest as someone being approached by God and given a command, but it does show his reluctance to obey, his reluctance to serve. And God answers him in kind. He says, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak." God's response to Moses is that he is sovereign over Moses' ability and intimate and intentional to work through him. We see a pretty similar interaction, like God to Moses, between another character in the Bible, Job, God and Job. It's in Job chapter 38, verses 4 through 11. And for context, this is at the end of the book of Job. And in the beginning, Job was a very wealthy man, known by everyone. He had everything that you could imagine. But one day, it all went away. He lost it all. And his wife told Job to curse God and die. And his friends blamed him for his loss, said that it was because he was unfaithful, because he was a sinner, that he lost everything. And after chapters and chapters and chapters of him being berated by his friends and wife, Job ends up mad and very mad at God. And questions him and doubts him. And this is God's response in Job 38, 4 through 11. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all of the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, 'Thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stood.'" In this interaction, much like his interaction with Moses, God is displaying his sovereignty over good and evil and what we would consider bad, with being mute and deaf and blind and lame. Paul, New Testament, was also someone that was claimed to speak without elegance. Or eloquence. In 1 Corinthians 2, verses 1, or 2, 1, verses 4, 1 through 4, you know what I mean. This is actually Paul speaking. He says, "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power." With Paul, God's wisdom was sufficient to make him one of the founders of the modern church. Just as with Moses, God was sufficient to speak through him and work in him and work miracles through him. God knew fully well Moses' capability to speech. He gave it to him. But his ability, his usefulness in this call does not matter on his ability. His usefulness in the call depends on his humility for God to work in and through him. God answers all of Moses' objections, not only with a solution, but with a promise of presence and guidance. But still, Moses answers one more time. But he said, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." Here it's clear that Moses doubts God's choice in him. With this, it is finally clear that all of Moses' objections were just masks for his lack of faith, were just excuses for his own disobedience. Because here, Moses moves from what could be considered humility to deliberate disobedience. And God answers him in kind. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I will be with your mouth and with his mouth. And I will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth. And you shall speak, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand the staff with which you shall do the signs." God's response to Moses' disobedience, God's response shows his sufficiency, requiring a response of obedience. And I read this and I can't help but have the question, how did Moses know that God was angry with him? Did the fire from the bush kind of flare up? Because Moses had already hidden his face from God because he was already afraid from him. We see that in Exodus 3, verse 6. So how much more overcome with fear did he have to be to completely change his mindset? The reality that deliberate disobedience would be far too much for him to comprehend is what changed his mind from disobedience to obedience. Because if he was talking to a Pharaoh, he would have been killed on the spot just by questioning him, much less the deliberate disobedience that he's been showing. But with God, his direct insubordination was met with grace in the face of God's righteous anger. And we can't imagine God's anger like ours. We can't humanize that. Because our emotions are riddled with sin. It's contaminated. But we also need to avoid reinterpreting God's righteous wrath as anything less than anger. It shows God's intimacy with his people, the way that he responds, that he is connected to his people and not far and distant and unable to be reached. Because when Moses was responding with reasonable excuses, when he was responding with reason, God answered him in kind. He responded with reason. But when it came to Moses' deliberate disobedience, God completely shut it down. Because there can no longer be any pushback on what God has called him to do. And that's the realization that he had to meet. Let's go through real quick. We'll just hit point by point. First, God is talking about Aaron, his brother. Moses and Aaron, as brothers, were both Levites, but the title of Levite was given to Aaron in this moment, signifying him becoming the head priest of Israel over Moses. And we see the reasoning being that he is eloquent of speech, and will be ready, willing, and joyous for the call. Just because he's the head priest doesn't mean that he's the leader of the Israelites. Because Moses, though he was slow of speech, was thoughtful and very attentive to God. And we see this play out in Exodus 32 when Aaron makes a golden calf for the Israelites, and Moses has to end up standing up, interceding on the Israelites' behalf towards God. And God continues, he says, "He shall speak for the people, and you shall be, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as a God to him." And whenever God says this, he's not presenting a hierarchy like Pharaoh is God of the Egyptians, but rather he's introducing the act of a prophet. The prophet is the mouthpiece of God. God speaks to and through Moses, and because he is slow of speech, not eloquent, he speaks to Aaron, and Aaron speaks for him. But all of this is surrounded by God's constant assurance of divine presence and aid. Finally, God says, "And you take in your hand the staff with which you shall do all of these signs." This interaction honestly reminds me of Jacob wrestling with God. Jacob wrestled with God for his own blessing. He wanted to make his own way, his own path. Moses wrestles with God because he doesn't want to take the path given by God. In both of these interactions, God, of course, is victorious, and he leaves the loser, Jacob and Moses, with a sign of remembrance. For Jacob, it was the broken hip. God broke his hip to remind him that God is in control, that it is God that sets his path, and he can no longer work on his own. God gives Moses the staff to remind him that he is not working on his own, that it is God that is speaking through him, that it is God that is working all of these miracles. I feel as though we're quick to insert ourselves into these texts. Like with David and Goliath, we can say that we are David and our sin, or the mountains in our way are Goliath. And here with Moses, we can say that God uses you no matter the excuses that you can make. God can use you. But the reality, and I really want y'all to hear this, and it's really true for me, especially right now, is that God doesn't need us to enact his will. But God is gracious to work in and through us to build his kingdom. Ultimately, Moses' excuses boiled down to disobedience and a lack of faith. Like I said at the beginning, this is something that I know we can all relate to. I can definitely relate to it. God calls us to love our neighbors, but they drive like maniacs most of the time. God calls us to be sober-minded, but I have all my vices under control. I have my rage under control. God calls us to be pure, but all of these things are so easy to access, and I need self-satisfaction. I need quick, instant gratification. But all of these things are just idols, idols that we make, and regardless of the excuses we have to cover them up, God's sufficiency demands that we follow the path he sets before us. God's sufficiency demands our obedience. I faced a similar situation with my own calling. Not as extreme. I didn't have a burning bush situation. But growing up, I felt a call to ministry in high school. But the only ministry experience I really had was in Young Life. I love Young Life. And when it came to going into college, when it came to my first year at Liberty to choose my master's, instead of going into youth ministry like I felt like I was called, I went into exercise science to go into physical therapy because I thought that I had spent so much time in physical therapy that it would have been so easy for me. But God was very quick to remind me that I'm not made for science. And after barely surviving that freshman year, I went in to study youth ministry my sophomore year. And obviously, I haven't looked back. But God's sufficiency demands our obedience. Now, there's a whole chapter in the book of Hebrews to talk about why God is greater than Moses. But I want to focus on a single moment in Mark 14, verses 32 through 36. In this moment, Jesus is faced with a similar situation as Moses. He's faced with his purpose. Moses' purpose was an exodus for God's people out of bondage to Egypt to the promised land. Jesus' purpose is an exodus for God's people out of bondage to sin to his eternal heavenly kingdom. And this is what separates Jesus from Moses. When they went to a place called Gethsemane, you guys know what I'm saying. He said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John, and he began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little bit farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but your will." That is what separates Jesus from Moses. Moses acted in disobedience. Ultimately, he acted in obedience, but he didn't see the promised land. Jesus, out of his faithfulness to God, even though he wanted the cup of God's righteous wrath towards our sin to pass from him in his humanity, he took it upon himself. He took all of our past, present, and future sin upon himself and died the death in our place, the death that we deserve, the death that we deserve as the people that put him on that cross, the people that made his sacrifice even needed to begin with. He died and he rose again, and he made a way for us to live with him for eternity in that holy kingdom, eternal kingdom. He saw it, and he made a way for us to get there. And all we have to do is obey. All we have to do is not act in cowardice, not make up our own excuses to continue to live in our vices, and in humility, obey him and accept him. And that's what he calls us to do. That being said, let's pray.